The Successors, written by Luke Mahler and produced by Chris Brown.
Hey everyone, I'm Luke Mahler, and this is the first episode of a series detailing an absolutely fascinating period in ancient history. The wars of Alexander the Great's successors, and the breakup of the great, glorious, and doomed Macedonian Empire. It's a tale worth telling, and I want to tell it. I plan to begin directly after the death of the great conqueror in Babylon, and continue until the death of the last man to strive for ultimate kingship. This particular game ends only when all pieces are removed from the board. Before I begin, though, a little context is probably necessary. This is the story of a man who rose out of the previously minor kingdom of Macedon, in the north of modern-day Greece, and led an army of 50,000 to victory after victory until he had conquered Asia Minor, Egypt, Syria, Palestine, Persia, Afghanistan, and even parts of India. And then suddenly, he died young of sickness, or possibly poison, in Babylon. The men who, in the years after his death, fought each other for dominance were, to a man, great leaders and commanders in their own right. They had learned the art of war from perhaps the greatest warrior who has ever lived, and the conflicts they waged against each other show it. In any case, the aftermath of Alexander's death unleashed an incredibly complex and intensely violent series of wars that lasted for 4 decades and more. The various protagonists are a diverse bunch. There are warriors and statesmen, tyrants and liberators, murderers and heroes to be found in equal measure. Every participant in the funeral games of the dead conqueror is fascinating in his or her own way, but every participant also shared one overriding quality above all others: brutal, all-consuming ambition. Among all the great generals and kings who strove for dominance over the whole empire, many came close, yet all failed, and except for one especially prudent general, all died by the swords of the men they had once fought alongside. So, without further ado, let's begin on a beautiful June day in 323 BC. One day after the death of Alexander III, king of Macedon and conqueror of the known world. As Alexander lay on his deathbed in his new, spear-won capital of Babylon, the air around him was thick with intrigue and plotting. Everyone of consequence knew that the succession was completely up in the air. Before his death, when asked who he planned to leave his vast empire to, Alexander is recorded to have said, "To the strongest." This pithy reply proved prophetic. So much so that I suspect the actual quote is a later fabrication, but whether or not Alexander actually spoke the words, his decision, or lack thereof, on the all-important transition of power, shows that he may as well have said it. In any case, in the immediate aftermath of his death, the strongest seems to have been a general named Perdiccas. A typical blue-blooded warrior aristocrat in the Macedonian tradition, he rose to commander of the elite companion cavalry, and consequently to Alexander's favor during the Indian campaigns. When the king finally died, Perdiccas held the most power and influence of any of the Macedonian magnates in Babylon. But unlike Alexander, his prestige and power did not dwarf his colleagues completely and totally. Perdiccas, skilled commander and first among equals that he was, could not simply impose his will upon the headstrong marshals of the Macedonian army. He shrewdly recognized that any truly unified regime he could create would absolutely have to share power with the other great generals. And it must be said, at this point, a truly unified regime was not a given. There was serious disagreement on how to govern the newly conquered empire. There were the loyalists and patriots, who were true to the royal Argead dynasty and demanded nothing short of a unified kingdom ruled by the legitimate blood heirs of Alexander. But there were also ambitious generals who sought to do away with the royal family entirely and rule in their own right. Still others wanted a big piece of the imperial pie for themselves, but thought that attempting to rule a unified empire was absolute madness. All of these men, general and commoner alike, would have to have at least some of their wishes accommodated in the settlement to come, or civil war would be certain. Now, Perdiccas knew this, and he drew support from the royalist party. Broadly speaking, this meant several notable Macedonian commanders, as well as the foot soldiers who fought in the phalanx. The aristocratic cavalry were more split. Some favored the royal line, though they differed on which of Alexander's sons to support, while others bound themselves to the personal ambitions of their commanders. Perdiccas immediately drew Eumenes of Cardia and Nearchus of Crete to his side. Though both were noted leaders, they were not Macedonian. Though there was no real cultural friction between Macedon and Greece at this time, there was still mutual contempt on both sides. It was not so long ago that the Greeks had fought hard against Macedon rather than for it, and many of them harbored a smoldering resentment towards Macedonian domination. For the Macedonians' part, they could never see these upstart Greeks as true equals or peers. That honor was reserved for the great Macedonian nobles, and them alone. Formidable though Perdiccas' forces were, he nearly lost the whole game right at the start of the match. When the initial council failed to achieve any meaningful consensus, a rough, man-of-the-people-type infantry commander named Meleager made a determined play to become the power behind the throne. Ostensibly fighting for the legitimacy of Alexander's mentally disabled brother Arrhidaeus, who would make a positively exemplary puppet king, he led the Macedonian infantry in an assault upon the palace. After a brief but bloody engagement, the more numerous infantry drove off Perdiccas' cavalry and forced his withdrawal from Babylon itself. For the space of a second, Meleager found himself close to becoming the de facto ruler of the entire empire. He held the key to the succession in his hands in the person of Arrhidaeus, and he had the support of the numerous and influential Macedonian infantry. He held the city of Babylon itself, and could probably defend it against whatever forces Perdiccas could muster.
Perdiccas, though, was no fool.
Rather than risking an all-out attack, he quickly and cleverly used superior cavalry to cut all supplies to the city. His ally Eumenes, showing his worth to Perdiccas for the first, but certainly not the last time, cut Meleager's support out from under him with an impressive display of oratory and negotiation. Meleager's soldiers, previously so committed to his cause, abandoned the rogue commander in droves and allowed the royalists into the city. Perdiccas entered Babylon in triumph, and in his triumph he showed all the world how magnanimous and merciful he was, by trampling Meleager's conspirators and followers to death with the royal war elephants. Meleager was left alive just long enough for the crisis to pass, and then was quietly murdered in temple. Whatever else he was, Perdiccas had proved himself decisive when decisiveness was needed. His authority, which had initially seemed ephemeral at best, was now at its height. The unity of the empire, with Perdiccas as regent for Alexander's son by the Bactrian princess Roxanne, was momentarily assured. After settling affairs in Babylon, Perdiccas called a new council, ostensibly to hand out new honors and titles to the various generals of the empire. However, only some attended. Many refused to leave their nascent power bases at all. Perdiccas' tactics against Meleager, effective though they were, did not inspire confidence in his word among the Macedonian marshals. General Antigonus One-Eye, who we shall certainly be hearing more of, categorically refused to come, instead concentrating on building up his own considerable forces in Phrygia. Generals Craterus and Polyperchon, leading 10,000 skilled Macedonian soldiers, kept right on marching towards Greece, refusing all orders to return to Babylon. Antipater, the regent of Macedon in the absence of the Grand Army, waited to receive them with open arms. Already, we see the seeds of dissent against Perdiccas being sown. In spite of the absence of so many great generals, Perdiccas made his appointments regardless. He was prudent enough to confirm Antigonus One-Eye, Antipater, and Craterus in their various commands in the Balkans and Asia Minor, knowing that he likely did not have the strength to force them out of their various strongholds. Two more men, Ptolemy and Lysimachus, were bold enough to request lands for themselves. Ptolemy wanted Egypt, and Lysimachus desired Thrace. Perhaps surprisingly, Perdiccas just gave in. Both were noted commanders with substantial followings, and by acceding to their demands, Perdiccas likely thought they would support his cause. If so, he was horribly mistaken. Both Ptolemy and Lysimachus dreamed ambitious dreams, and those dreams had no place for Perdiccas as their superior. Both men had chosen wisely. Egypt was the perfect base for Ptolemy, with a supremely defensible frontier warded by vast expanses of desert and a wealth to make greedy Macedonians the world over begin salivating. Meanwhile, Lysimachus' choice of Thrace played to his strengths. The fractious Thracian tribes would need a strong man to keep them in line, and that strong man could benefit from their warlike nature if he played his cards correctly. And Lysimachus, as later events will show, certainly did not lack for strength. Even if he was unaware of Lysimachus and Ptolemy's motives, Perdiccas surely knew of the ambitions of the great Western generals. And in response, he dispatched to Asia Minor the one man he knew he could count on to support his regime, Eumenes of Cardia, the Greek. Being a non-Macedonian, Eumenes knew he could never make a bid for the throne. Any influence he acquired would have to be through service in a stable and secure regime that looked upon him favorably, and this was precisely what Perdiccas was offering him. In spite of his non-Macedonian origins, Eumenes was a brilliant commander with a conspicuous ability to both inspire great feats in his men and to rebound from terrible adversity. For these reasons, Perdiccas dispatched him with a large detachment of the imperial army to watch over the untrustworthy generals of the West, Antigonus, Craterus, Antipater, and the rest. However, in the course of the various feuds of the Macedonian nobles, the hitherto invincible Macedonian Empire had presented a possible Achilles heel to peoples previously cowed into submission. The conquered remains of the old Persian Empire, full of hate though they may have been, were largely unable to take advantage of this weakness. The imperial army was still stationed all over the east, and any rising would have had little chance of success. Yet there remained one people who valued liberty above all else, and, despite the great forces arrayed against them, took up arms against the domineering Macedonians who sought to enslave them. And these people were called the Greeks. Though men such as Eumenes might swear themselves to the new regime, this sentiment was by no means universal among the Greeks at the time. Demosthenes, the great orator, remained in Athens, and his popularity and hatred for Macedon were equally great. Hearing of Alexander the Great's death, Demosthenes saw his chance for freedom, possibly the last chance he or his city would ever get. In a series of inspired speeches, he rallied the Athenian people to rise up. And what a rising it was. Strengthened by the defection of a Greek clerk named Harpalus, who brought a massive hoard of stolen Macedonian gold along with him, the Athenians called up the old hoplite levy and hired thousands of mercenaries, and dared the Macedonians to once again face the anger of men who would be free. Inspired by this turn of events, revolutionaries on the island of Rhodes attacked and defeated the local Macedonian garrison, expelling them from the island and proudly proclaiming a democracy. They soon set to work fortifying their island against the certainty of the Macedonian counterattack. Almost simultaneously, a massive force of Greek mercenaries stationed in Bactria, modern-day Afghanistan, rebelled against the rulers of the province, declaring their intent to march all the way back to Greece. If they succeeded, the famous expedition of Xenophon would pale in comparison to their exploits. The commanders of the Greek force had tens of thousands of troops at their command, and felt confident they could overcome any resistance on the way, even the invincible Macedonian army. This war that the Greeks are about to wage against Antipater is usually called the Lamian War, after the city where much of the action will take place. On the surface, it seems like the Greeks started at a grave disadvantage. Though their courage could not be doubted, the recent military record of Greek armies against Macedon did not inspire confidence. In the initial Macedonian conquest of Greece, Greek resistance was fraught with disunity and infighting. Many Greeks refused to fight the Macedonians, instead siding with Philip and Alexander, or just remaining neutral. The army that did meet the Macedonians at Chaeronea was hardly a pan-Greek army of liberation. Athens and Thebes were the only notable states willing to fight the rising power in the north, and their performance at the Battle of Chaeronea only cemented the complete military superiority of the Macedonians over their thoroughly beaten southern neighbor. Several years later, while Alexander was deep in Asia fighting the Persians, the vaunted Spartans rose up against Antipater, and it seemed like, at least initially, they might drive him out of the Peloponnese entirely. The typically heroic Spartan king Agis managed to drive back the Macedonian garrison of the city of Corinth, but Antipater's full army was too much for the Spartans. Agis died a hero, but his revolt died with him, and Macedonian hold on Greece was stronger than ever. So, we may ask, what the hell were the Greeks thinking? Surely they stood no chance whatsoever against the conquerors of the known world, the oppressors who defeated them again and again. Certainly, Alexander was dead, and divisions were appearing in the imperial government, but his generals and armies remained very much alive, and no amount of disorganization would help the Greeks if they could not best the Macedonian army in battle. The Greeks would need a hero, a new Themistocles to lead them to victory, and cometh the hour, cometh the man. The man in question was named Leosthenes, and he was the last and best leader of free Athens. For a man who quite possibly could have turned back the tides of history,
there's frustratingly little information on him. Unlike the other great men of this period, the Perdiccases and Antigonuses and Ptolemies, he simply appears, with no warning, in the historical record soon after Alexander's death. However, he must have been a man with an excellent military reputation, since he was immediately entrusted with the leadership of the Greek war effort. I think it's extremely likely that he served with Alexander in the East, and this may help explain why the Greeks thought so highly of him. He would hardly be the first or only Greek to win glory and favor in Alexander's campaigns. In any case, he must have held a position of some authority, since his first appearance is at the head of a powerful force of thousands of mercenaries destined for demobilization. The Athenians, however, had other ideas. When Leosthenes arrived in Athens, his countrymen immediately granted him full power to bring his mercenaries over to the Greek side. The Athenians could not have asked for a greater gift. Outnumbered and outgunned as they were, Leosthenes and his men proved to be a godsend. Immediately, things started to look up for the Athenians. Their fellow Greeks were excited by the initial successes of the revolt, and soon, Leosthenes found himself leading a full-blown coalition. Several significant cities joined, including Phocis and Argos, but the real prize was the allegiance of the powerful and newly formed Aetolian League. The Aetolians were famous, as early as the Peloponnesian War, for their skill at guerrilla warfare and bravery in battle. But disunity prevented the various Aetolian tribes from making their presence felt in Greece. However, by the time of the Macedonian conquest of Greece, the Aetolians had formed a great federation to protect themselves from outside dominance. Seeing a potential way to ensure their security forever, the Aetolians joined in the revolt against Macedon with massive enthusiasm. Leosthenes' army was likely around 10 to 12,000. A significant force, to be sure, but not a force capable of driving Antipater from Greece. Alexander had left Antipater with 13,000 of the skilled Macedonian infantry, as well as 600 cavalry to hold Greece. But this figure doesn't include the levies Antipater would be able to raise from Macedon's subject in the Balkan Peninsula. Leosthenes and the Athenians were in a precarious position. Until the Aetolians joined in the revolt, that is. The Aetolians committed many soldiers to the war effort. I've heard estimates from 7,000 to 12,000, but almost certainly more than any other Greek state. And just like that, Leosthenes knew he had a fighting chance. But while Leosthenes and the Greeks gathered their forces, Antipater was far from idle. He set to raising his forces and examined his options. On the one hand, he could have called his fellow generals back from Europe. The Greek army was by now a very formidable force, and the other great marshals had no more desire than Antipater to see the Greeks throw off Macedonian domination. On the other hand, he could march on the Greeks immediately. They had, after all, never managed to truly defeat the Macedonians in the past. They had their day in the sun decades and centuries ago, but now they were weak and in decline. Surely their pathetic resistance would give way before the superior martial valor of Macedon, as all foreign resistance inevitably did. The possibility of a Greek victory must have seemed distant indeed. With this in mind, Antipater mustered his army and marched south into Thessaly, picking up a large contingent of the excellent Thessalian cavalry. The southern Greeks had never been known for their mastery of the horse, and Antipater could be confident that his army would be able to use its better cavalry to outmaneuver his foes. But Antipater had underestimated those foes. Leosthenes was no amateur like the classical Greek generals of old, but a professional soldier with an extremely firm grasp on all aspects of warfare. The historian Diodorus Siculus says this of Leosthenes and his soldiers. For these men, who had campaigned throughout Asia for a long time and had taken part in many great conflicts, had become masters of warfare. Masters of warfare. High praise indeed. But, as we will see, not at all undeserved. When he heard that Antipater was moving southwards, Leosthenes acted with his customary decisiveness. He had studied his military history and knew that the best way to defend Greece was to follow in the footsteps of the great Spartan king Leonidas. He would seize the famous pass of Thermopylae and make Antipater play the part of Xerxes. But Antipater was ready for this. He had many friends among the perennially disunited Greeks and supposed he could keep Leosthenes occupied with fighting his countrymen long enough to come south and crush the revolt once and for all. The Boeotians of central Greece were allied to Macedon and needed little encouragement to raise an army of their own, intending to join Antipater and destroy the overawed Greek coalition before Leosthenes could marshal all of his forces. But Leosthenes moved far too quickly for the Boeotians, and they soon found themselves alone, facing him across the plains of Plataea. The Boeotians drew up their men in front of their camp, ready to withdraw if the battle went poorly. Leosthenes ordered a general attack, and the result was a complete victory for the Greek coalition. The Boeotians may have been able to handle the Athenians and other Greeks, but Leosthenes and his retinue of personal soldiers were far too much for them. The Boeotian phalanx broke apart and fled back to the camp, but Leosthenes pursued them and took the camp itself. The coalition had won. Even though their foes were allies of Macedonians rather than the Macedonians themselves, it remained a victory, the first that the Greeks had won in a very, very long time. But Leosthenes had no time to rest on his laurels. The main Macedonian army remained undefeated and was swiftly moving through Thessaly and would soon be at the pass of Thermopylae. After settling affairs in Boeotia, he moved the full force of the Greek army up to meet Antipater in the field. The Macedonian general remained confident, despite the Allied victory in the south, and accepted Leosthenes' offer of battle. But as the two armies neared each other, something changed. On the very eve of battle, Antipater's ace in the hole simply disappeared. The vaunted Thessalian cavalry, the main striking power of Antipater's army, had joined the Greeks. I found no satisfactory account of this event apart from a few references, but it seems that the bravery and determination of the Greek forces had made a great impression on the Thessalians. They too had been under the Macedonian boot for decades, and their southern cousins' bid for freedom struck them as noble, right, and most of all, viable. The successes of the Greek coalition gave hope that the Greeks might be free once more, and this hope proved a powerful motivator. Leosthenes and the Athenians repeatedly sent messages to the Thessalians, stoking their patriotism and begging them to stand up for their liberty. Did they not see that they were about to strike down men who were their friends and champions? Whether out of remorse, patriotism, or more prosaic motives, the Thessalians brought the full force of their cavalry over to the Greeks. Now, finally, Leosthenes saw his chance. Forgoing the strategy of the Spartans against the Persians, he actually moved out to attack the Macedonian army. The Thessalian cavalry were most effective when they had plenty of room to maneuver, and though details of the battle are few, it seems likely that this was the decisive factor. Leosthenes drew up his men in serried ranks and moved against the Macedonian pikemen confidently. The infantry battle was likely a bloody affair, with the long spears of the Macedonian formation holding Leosthenes' Greek infantry at bay. The Greek citizen militia had no answer to the Macedonian pikemen. Historically, whenever the two had done battle, the Greeks met with disaster, as at Chaeronea. Yet, Leosthenes was no citizen soldier, and this was not Chaeronea. In Leosthenes, the Macedonians faced a foe who was intimately familiar with their tactics. They would not surprise him, and he knew precisely how to break a Macedonian formation. Seeing his men unable to penetrate the impenetrable wall of pikes, Leosthenes sent his Thessalians to outflank the enemy formation. And a miraculous thing happened. The invincible Macedonian army turned, threw down their weapons, and ran for their lives. Antipater was, however, able to maintain a semblance of discipline over much of the broken army and conducted an ordered retreat into the nearby city of Lamia. But this was a small consolation. Leosthenes was hot on his heels, and suddenly Antipater was trapped. Leosthenes ordered a complete blockade of the city and mobilized the newly constructed Greek fleet. For the first time in decades, Athenian triremes sailed out into the wine-dark sea. The Greeks were delirious with excitement. This man, this Leosthenes, had done what no man in the world had done. He had led an army to a decisive, genuine victory over a Macedonian force. Though the Macedonians had suffered setbacks before, the Spartans had inflicted one such on them during their revolt. It is hard to overestimate the impact of this victory. The best and only Macedonian army in all of Europe was trapped by the Greeks, and any attempt to reinforce that army would have to first overcome the large Greek fleet as well as the growing divisions within the Macedonian court. It was a dark day for Macedon. Leosthenes, after all, had defeated the Macedonians because, quite simply, he had learned all the military lessons they had inadvertently taught. Leosthenes' politicking with the Thessalians, as well as his tactics in the battle, took a page right out of the Macedonian playbook. He divided enemies along cultural and political lines, used cavalry as the arm of decision, and employed professional soldiers. Leosthenes, in short, showed the Macedonians what could happen when their own strategies were used against them. A foreboding prediction of the bloody and complex civil wars to come. I think that's a good place to leave it for today. But before I go, one more note. The sources for the Lamian War are extremely unsatisfactory, and I've done my best to reconstruct a coherent narrative out of the fragments available. My account of Leosthenes' tactics at Thermopylae are based upon similar examples in better recorded battles, where the actual primary sources are sufficient, unlike the Lamian War. So I apologize for any inaccuracy. As we move into the better recorded areas of the Successors' Wars, this should probably be less of a problem. In any case, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.